Hello and welcome to Coffee House Shots, the Spectator's daily politics podcast. I'm Isabel Hardman and this is the Sunday Roundup. Louise Hague resigned as Transport Secretary this week after it emerged she had committed a fraud offence in 2013, falsely telling police she had lost her work mobile phone in a mugging before finding it later. In 2022, Starmer had declared to the Commons, "Lawbreakers cannot be lawmakers." On Sky News, Trevor Phillips asked Cabinet Minister Pat McFadden if Keir Starmer had known about the offence before appointing Hague to Cabinet.
All right, let's come back to some domestic issues. And sorry to start here, but of course I have to. Did Keir Starmer know the full story of Louise Hague's crime when he appointed her to the Cabinet?
I don't know that. I only know what I've read in the newspapers in the last few days.
Steady. You're telling me they put you out on Sunday morning and they didn't tell you what the Prime Minister knew. I mean, that in itself feels like... How can you do that?
Look, Lou Hague is a good colleague. I'm sorry to see that she's gone. I think she was doing a good job. But she's made that decision. We've got a new Secretary of State now, Hadi Alexander, who I think will do a good job. I know that...
Yeah, but you just slid past the question I asked you. Did Keir Starmer know the full story when he appointed her to the Cabinet?
I don't know who knew what when. What I know is that she made the decision to resign. We've got a new appointment, Hadi Alexander, in place. And... That will mean that we continue with the agenda we've got, which is bringing the railways back into public ownership, giving the mayors and the local authorities more control over their buses, having a good transport agenda going forward.
Really great try. But, OK, let me put this another way. What changed between Thursday morning when Number 10 was saying there's a problem, but Louise Hague is safe in her position, and Friday morning? What did the Prime Minister or Number 10 or somebody learn?
Well, there's obviously new information that's come to light. There's been a lot of reporting around this. And by the time we get to the end of Thursday, Lou has made the decision to resign. And once that's done, a new appointment is put in place.
She made this completely on her own, didn't tell anybody why, didn't say, oh, I've changed my mind, oh, I've got some new information.
She did tell us why, because she wrote her resignation letter. And in the resignation letter... She sets out her reasons that this was going to become an enormous distraction for the government and decides to step down. And I respect her for doing that.
And the Prime Minister was a completely passive actor in this. He had no conversation, he didn't say
anything. Sure they did have conversations, and the result was she resigned. We've got a new Secretary of State and we carry on with our transport agenda.
New figures have shown that net migration to the UK hit a record 906,000 last year, much higher than previously thought. This week, Conservative leader Kemi Badenoch admitted that the Tories had failed on their immigration promises and announced plans for a strict numerical cap on visas, although she did not give any indication on what that number would be. Trevor Phillips asked if this plan might affect the numbers of seasonal workers that farmers rely on.
Your remark about this bearing fruit, it bites a really cheesy pun, but you were talking to the farmers this week, and you're right. You said the leader of the opposition said you would bring in a cap on the number, including for seasonal workers. When you were out marching with the farmers, did you mention that you want to cut off their supply of fruit pickers and farmhands if you got back into power?
No, what we were talking about was the incredibly dangerous impact that this family farms tax is going to have on family farms and indeed the very fruit farms that you're referencing, Trevor.
I got that, but I'm asking about the facing farms. Kemi Badenoch didn't mention in her speech on the platform, by the way, farmers, I'm going to bring in a cap that means that you won't be able to bring in as many seasonal workers as you want.
Well,
or am I wrong?
I'm going to a farm in Kent on Monday, so I will talk about this. But the number one issue they are facing at the moment is the family farm tax.
No. Come on, I'm asking about the number.
Trevor, this is...
That is not the number one issue, actually, they're facing at the moment. The number one issue is whether the fruit rot in the field. Are you going to put a cap on their numbers?
You're quite right. Actually, it's the national insurance hike that is going to cause already cash-poor farms to struggle to employ people. So this budget was a nightmare for family farms and the farming industry, which is why on Wednesday we are forcing the government to the dispatch box to explain this measure, but also to force Labour MPs to decide whether they're going to back their farmers or suck up to Keir Starmer and Rachel Reeves. And we want them to join us in axing this family farm tax.
If I may say so, this is a spectacular and valiant attempt to avoid answering the question which I asked you. Will the cap that you propose reduce the numbers of seasonal workers available to farmers?
The very fact that Kemi talked about this week shows that we want to have a conversation about this. She has set out the measures that... Well, Trevor, be fair.
I'm having a conversation with you now, and I'm simply asking you, will it reduce the number of seasonal workers or not?
So we will formulate this policy, the details of this policy... over the coming months, as in fairness, Kemi has said she wants to do, to set out our principles and our values and then set out the way in which those policies will be operationalised. But what is noticeable is that with all of this, the budget shows how little this government cares about or understands the countryside, because they would not have done what they have done with these various taxes. It's not just the family farm tax, it's the tax on fertiliser, and many, many other things that they're doing.
All right, well, let's declare a truce on this, that you're still working it out, right?
Next week, Keir Starmer will give a speech declaring long-term missions and his plan for change, which some are viewing as an attempted reset for the government. Sitting on Victoria Derbyshire's panel, Labour MP Diane Abbott was asked how she felt Starmer's time in power had gone so far.
Let's talk about Keir Starmer. He's got this big speech next week on his missions, his priorities for government. Some are seeing it as a bit of a relaunch. You hadn't always been a fan of Sir Keir Starmer. It's no secret because of how you felt you were treated by him. How do you think this Labour government and Keir Starmer as Prime Minister are doing so far?
Well, it's interesting that they've wheeled out the recycled Blairite pact. I don't know, they always wheel him out when they've got a problem. There's been issues where I think Keir Starmer has shown poor judgment. He didn't seem to understand that a man on £150,000 a year, as leader of the opposition, it would look bad if he was getting a millionaire to pay for his glasses and his suits. He didn't seem to understand. Maybe if he'd done more door-knocking for the Labour Party, didn't understand of all the people to take money off, not pensioners. Pensions don't forgive and forget. And they're one of the blocks of voters who actually do vote. And he didn't seem to get it, that would be a problem. People are still coming up to my colleagues in other parts of the country in the street to complain about what he did about winter fuel.
But why should wealthy pensioners get winter fuel payments?
I understand that argument. I actually believe in universal benefits. What I'm saying is, by taking winter fuel allowance away from pensioners, isn't that a rather clunking way? It showed poor political judgment.
Islamist rebels had captured central Aleppo and other territory across northwestern Syria in a surprise offensive, which is the most significant challenge to President Bashar al-Assad's regime in years. Victoria Derbyshire spoke to the BBC's international editor, Jeremy Bowen.
First of all, who are these rebels and what do they want?
Well, they want to get rid of the regime, clearly. There are a number of factions involved in it. The dominant one is known as HTS, and it's controlled the one province that's been still under the control of rebels, called Idlib, which borders Turkey, and it's very close to Aleppo. Aleppo is only about 50 miles from the Turkish border, and they have been there controlling the area, and there's been a ceasefire, which has been pretty much observed since 2020, I think. But what they've done is now, I think they've taken advantage of the weakness of Assad's main allies, Iran, Hezbollah of Lebanon, and also the fact that Russia's looking elsewhere into Ukraine. The reason why Assad survived the civil war, why his regime did, was because of those three forces helping him out. And now, frankly, they've all got bigger fish to fry.
So does that mean President Assad could be toppled?
Well, perhaps, but, he went through situations during the long war that started in 2011 where large areas of his capital were in control of the rebels.
Right.
And what turned the tide was Russia intervening militarily in 2015. But, you know, in, say, 2012, 2013, at the very beginning of the war, you could literally drive from the centre of Damascus and maybe 3 miles later find rebels. They were that close. So, you know, his regime is resilient, and also quite a lot of Syrians, actually, they don't love him, but they felt during the height of the civil war that he was the least bad option because they were really worried about jihadists, extremists. So the leader of this group, HTS, has over the years tried to show that he's different. He broke with al-Qaeda.
Right.
They've allowed a certain amount of, think of freedom of worship, education of women, that sort of thing, which, so he's trying to say, I'm a different person than that.
Okay. We remember from the Civil War that led to a refugee crisis. Many refugees going to Turkey, to Germany and Jordan. Could we see the same now?
Well, if anything, it's possibly the other way around because right. people who are fleeing the regime might even want to come back. And actually, because of everything that's been going on in Lebanon in the last few months, there have been Syrian refugees going back to Syria because of what's going on in Lebanon, and also Lebanese running away from that particular war. You know, I think that what we're seeing here, this is all a result of the way that the Middle East is in total flux in the continuing aftermath and fallout of the Hamas attacks last year on the 7th of October. This is yet another consequence of those new circumstances.
MasterChef host Greg Wallace has stepped back from his role while multiple complaints of inappropriate sexual behaviour are investigated. In an Instagram post, Wallace claimed that only middle-class women of a certain age had complained. Victoria Derbyshire's panel reacted to his intervention.
And earlier this morning, Greg Wallace shared on Instagram what he thinks about the allegations against him.
Now, I've been doing MasterChef for 20 years. Amateur, celebrity and professional MasterChef. And I think in that time, I have worked with over 4,000 contestants of all different ages, all different backgrounds, all walks of life. And apparently now, I'm reading in the paper, there's been 13 complaints in that time. Now, in the newspaper, I can see the complaints coming from a handful of middle-class women of a certain age just from Celebrity MasterChef. This isn't right. In 20 years, over 20 years of television, can you imagine how many women, female contestants on MasterChef, have made sexual remarks or sexual innuendo? Can you imagine?
Well, there's quite a bit to unpack there. Hugh, you know Greg Wallace a little. What do you think of this intervention from him?
I think the intervention is not wise. I don't know Greg well. I've met him a couple of times. He's very likeable. He's a very professional screen presence. I have a very talented chef on MasterChef right at the moment, and she's doing incredibly well, and I've been really enjoying watching her and enjoying Greg's presenting. I think it's likely that Greg has what we might call a bawdy sense of humour. Clearly, that's offended people. I think one of the issues is that down the years, people have not felt able to tell him when he might want to rein it in a bit, and clearly he's crossed some lines. In terms of how he's going about defending himself, I understand the instinct when you feel you're backed into a corner, but I don't think it's smart to come out talking like that when at the moment he should probably be listening.
Diane Abbott, can I ask you specifically about the bit from Mr. Wallace? I can see the complaints coming from a handful of middle-class women of a certain age. What do you think of that?
It's not a crime to be a middle-class woman of a certain age, I would say. Greg doesn't get it. The world has moved on. Back in the day, he could touch up women and harass women.
Well, there's no suggestion that he's done that. Absolutely no suggestion that he's done that at all.
Back in the day, he could harass women. And it was about power, really. Women weren't in a position to say anything or do anything. He just doesn't understand that the world has moved on.
And just to repeat, through his lawyers, he has said it's entirely false that he engages in behaviour of a sexually harassing nature. Craig McKinley, are there questions, more questions for the BBC about another presenter?
Well, I hope there's not, but if there are whistleblowers out there whose whistle has been blown and have not been listened to by the BBC, I hope it's not another one of these stories that should have been looked at earlier. But, I mean, I'm not going to stand in judgment of Greg. I don't know him. He was well on the way of becoming a national treasure with the type of programmes he's doing. You know, is he bawdy? Is he, a bit laddish? I think, as Diana said, the barrier has moved over the years, and perhaps he is overstretched into lewd behaviour, sexual behaviour, but that is for the investigation to look into. And I agree with you, probably at the moment he's best to shut up and see where it goes.
Yeah. The BBC, by the way, say we take any issues that are raised with us seriously and we have robust processes in place to deal with them. We're always clear that any behaviour which falls below the standards expected by the BBC will not be tolerated.
That's all for this week. I'm Isabel Hardman, and this podcast was produced by Joe Bedell-Brill. Don't forget to subscribe to the Coffee House Shots podcast on the iTunes store. And if you enjoyed this podcast, do subscribe to our daily Evening Blend email. It's a free roundup of all the political news each day, along with analysis and a diary on what to expect next. Just go to spectator.co.uk/blend. Thanks for listening, and do join us again next week.